Devamitra Swami was born in New York City, but currently he's based in New Zealand and Australia. He has a lot of outreach programs that are taking place there. And for the past 30 years, he's been practicing the science of Bhakti Yoga, or studying the science of Bhakti Yoga that has stemmed from the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita in ancient India. Over those 30 years, his study has taken him all around the world, to all six continents around the globe. Of note, places like Siberia, like I already mentioned, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, India, United States, and certainly now Canada. So it's nice to have such a global traveler in a very cosmopolitan, multicultural, global city like Toronto. It's almost fitting. So we're very happy to have him here. Some notes is that he gives talks at prestigious universities all around the world. He graduated from Yale University in 1972, and after that discovered or came into contact with the science of Bhakti Yoga, and again has been practicing for over 30 years. Currently he is an advisor for the Russian Chamber of Commerce on Spiritual Economics, which is very nice. And on the note of the topic tonight, he's inspired many people around the world, many of those who are already practitioners of Bhakti Yoga, or many who are interested in the ancient teachings of India, to take up a vegetarian lifestyle. As we'll soon learn, I'm sure, in the talk, as to the spiritual dimension of what vegetarianism and veganism can provide. We're very happy to see that he's inspired many people, countless numbers of people all around the world, from all different countries, to take up this lifestyle. So I hope that you can join me in welcoming a big Toronto welcome to His Holiness Devamitra Swami.
Mantra chanting that you heard is directly related to food. The sound of the Hare Krishna mantra is making a connection between your individual consciousness and the Supreme Consciousness. Now, how does that relate to food? Stay tuned. You see, what distinguishes you from matter is that you are a conscious entity. You have a material covering in terms of bone and flesh and blood and so forth. But there's something about you that cannot be reduced to material explanation, no matter how hard you try. And that is your consciousness. So Lord Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that your consciousness is the energy of your non-material identity, a unit of consciousness known as the soul. Scientists have a great difficulty understanding consciousness through the material framework. And that should let them know that the real identity of the person is non-material. When the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra happens, there is a direct connection established between your unit of spiritual consciousness and the supreme, all-inclusive consciousness. And as you become more and more adept at that mantra chanting, a dynamic interchange happens between the limited unit of consciousness and the unlimited unit of consciousness. And so that is the topmost pleasure of life. Ordinarily, when we're within the matrix of illusion, we're forced to reciprocate with matter. And this is a very frustrating, very debilitating experience. We're trying to get a particular taste out of our interaction with matter. But we are conscious, sentient beings. So how can we truly be satisfied with our interactions with matter? Now, the more that we make connection through sound, sacred sound, and the ancient Vedic texts of India particularly recommend this Hare Krishna mantra as the Maha mantra, the foremost mantra, the more that our dormant spiritual consciousness springs to the fore. We're making that connection. Now, interesting it is that this mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra, is directly connected to food, because India has a age-old spiritual practice of before taking any kind of food, and any kind means no meats, etc. Those things are not considered food according to the Vedic standard. So before taking any kind of food that human beings should be eating, you accompany your food preparation with the spiritual sound, the Hare Krishna mantra, so that you're making the connection in two ways with the Supreme Consciousness, with Krishna, through sound and then also through the food. In other words, the food becomes also a vehicle for connection to the Supreme Source. And when that food is prepared in such consciousness, that food has an amazing transformative power on your consciousness and indeed on your whole life. Now, I'd like to go to the subject of eating so that there's no karmic reaction. Let me give you a natural example, a nature example, from the ancient Vedic texts, particularly the one called Srimad Bhagavatam. Some of you may be familiar with Bhagavad Gita. Well, Srimad Bhagavatam is the graduate study of Bhagavad Gita. There it explains that sometimes in the forest, bamboo planks rub together and therefore fire breaks out. No one has gone into the forest to start a fire, but just by the apparently random interaction of the bamboo, so much heat is generated that fire breaks out and lays waste the whole forest. Similarly, if we look at the world situation with that same, using that bamboo in the forest as a metaphor, we see that conflicts are always breaking out. This person against that person, this ethnic group against that ethnic group, this nation against that nation. What's going on? If you look more closely at what happens with the bamboo in the forest, it is the wind that rubs the bamboo stalks, you might say, together and causes the friction. So similarly, what is it that's causing the rub in human affairs? According to the ancient Vedic text, the rub, the friction, is caused by karmic reaction. And a salient method for burdening yourself and human society with a heavy load of bad karma is diet. Certainly, we all are familiar with the health reasons for a non-meat diet. But the Vedic text asks us to look at even a bigger picture beyond physical health. Look at consciousness and its reactions. When a conscious living entity, especially we're talking about, let me narrow that focus, we're talking about human beings with their developed consciousness when they voluntarily choose to inflict unnecessary pain on other creatures. There's a huge karmic reaction. So that karmic reaction is the wind that's causing the friction, and then the bamboo rubs together, fire breaks out. Similarly, the wind of karma amongst human beings causes all the inexplicable wars, inexplicable social conflicts. According to the Vedic sages, the Krishna conscious sadhus, it will not be possible to stop violence amongst human beings unless they learn how to eat in a karma-free way. We can't have peace amongst human beings while they're declaring war unnecessarily on defenseless poor creatures. So this is the greater implication of your diet. And I was very fascinated to note the spontaneity that you all took to the mantra chanting. You took to it in such a, zesty way, impediment-free way. Now, I know why that is so. You're not carrying on your consciousness such a burden of being implicated in the conspiracy of animal slaughter. Therefore, your consciousness, free from that heavy load, can just naturally spring forth in such a spontaneous and blissful way. So usually when I speak to audiences, it takes a lot of energy because they have so many lifestyle impediments. They don't understand that by their diet, by their meat-eating diet, they're not only hurting their health, but they're also dulling their consciousness. I don't have to go through those barriers here, so it's such a great relief. I can go right to the next level, which is the spiritualization of food, just like there's the spiritualization of sound. Yes, food can be a prime method for connecting to the source of all consciousness, for connecting to Krishna. Therefore, it is a common practice amongst spiritual practitioners of bhakti in India. And scholars of religion have noted that the bhakti school is the biggest school in India. Although there's so many things going on in the Indian subcontinent, the bhakti school, technically known by religious scholars as Vaishnavism, is the biggest strand. So, in that school, known in the West as Krishna consciousness, food plays such an enormous role as a means of divine connection. In fact, my spiritual teacher and the prime exponent of bhakti yoga outside of India has stated that bhakti, or Krishna consciousness, is the kitchen religion. Because preparing food plays such a major role in connecting to the Supreme. Now, first let's understand the negatives. An improper diet causes violence amongst human beings. Sometimes it's said that, well, you have to eat somewhere on the food chain. So in that sense, you're always going to cause violence. If you eat a head of broccoli, who knows, you might have consumed a few hundred ants. The plants also are living creatures. Granted, there are some plant food that you can take that doesn't finish off the whole plant, but there are other plant foods that you could say finish off the entity. So, some persons point out, and I often have to deal with this argument, that why should we be so fastidious show so careful to avoid animal slaughter when you gotta slaughter anyway to eat. So therefore, the heck with it all. And actually, your true spiritual development will be shown by just accepting whatever food comes your way. That will show your renunciation, your detachment, your non-attachment. Just rely on whatever food is around you, no matter what it is. Because any way that you eat will cause a bit of commotion in nature if there is some violence. Now, actually, from the perspective of the ancient Vedic knowledge, there's some truth to that, although it's distorted. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's stated in Sanskrit, jivo jivasya jivanam. The fact of life in this world is that one living entity is food for another. So you can't avoid implication in karma, no matter how you eat, whether you're a vegan or a vegetarian. Still, there is a huge difference between the karmic reactions you get by slaughtering an animal, which has much more developed consciousness than plants, and if you have a plant-based diet. It's kind of like, let's give a rough example, it's like the difference between someone who does a hit and run, hit somebody with their car, and the person dies, and you just take off. How can you compare that to someone who has parked in their parking space 10 more minutes than the meter allows? So, yes, there is some infraction, but how can you compare the two? But sometimes, even people who say that they're spiritual, they want to equate it all. You kill animals, you eat a grape, it's all the same thing. Yeah, for the heck with making any distinctions. In fact, they say, how can there be a karma-free diet when you have to eat something and your eating is going to cause some little tremor, at least? Now, yes, it's true. One living entity is food for another. Therefore, we have to try to identify what foods are allotted for creatures of advanced developed consciousness, human beings. What is the overall system that we should be become aware of, so that even though we have to eat something, the karmic reaction is at least minimized, but better than that is no karma at all. So an essential part of bhakti yoga is the karma-free diet, beyond even vegetarianism and veganism. A diet in which you take permission from the Supreme Source, from Krishna, before you eat anything. And in this way, you're protected from the reactions. So this is all about connecting to the Supreme Source of all energy. The Hare Krishna mantra is about energy and the energetic source. Hare refers to spiritual energy, and Krishna and Rama refer to the source of all that energy. So the Hare Krishna mantra is an invocation of connection with the spiritual energy and the source of all spiritual energy. When you combine that with your food preparation, then the bhakti yogis will tell you, your food becomes spiritualized. It becomes a conveyor of spiritual potency, which not only is free from any karmic reaction, but also that food, as a conveyor of spiritual potency, can ignite heightened spiritual consciousness in the eater. In this way, the consciousness of the cook affects anyone who eats that food. Now, this is not only true for advanced transcendentalists. It's also true, let me tell you, even in the mundane way. If you're eating food from someone whose consciousness is saturated with passion and ignorance, a very materialistic person, their consciousness goes into the food. So you're not only eating their cooking, but you're also eating their consciousness. And as you become more sensitive in your yogic practice and your meditation, you'll start to become aware more and more of these things, that all of a sudden your mind becomes filled with kind of low thoughts that normally you wouldn't have, and you wonder where it came from, and then you realize it's coming through the food. The person who cooked for me was in very low consciousness, and now that low consciousness is infecting me. And similarly, the converse. If the cook has high consciousness, you'll become infected with high consciousness. So, this is why we say bhakti yoga, or Krishna consciousness, is the kitchen religion. Because, according to the depth of the spiritual practice, so many persons can become inspired, spiritually inspired, and indeed there can actually be a change in society just by eating highly sanctified food offered to Krishna in with love and devotion. This is yoga cooking, the sacred kitchen. And I feel that this is the next step that attuned persons will be turning to, the sacred kitchen, yoga cooking, meditational cooking, in such a way that the eaters are elevated, they're transported even to the spiritual dimension. So, we bear in mind the negative, we want to be free from karmic reactions. Even though we're not eating meats, we still are aware that we're eating some living creatures. What is the proper diet meant for a human being? By knowing that, you would avoid the major karmic reactions. Then, as you become more attuned and more sensitive, you wonder, well, I have to eat something. I'm living in this world. Okay, I'm eating very low on the food chain. I'm eating a plant-based diet. Still, what gives me the right to eat the plants? They have lives too. In fact, some of you may have been, you may be aware of research done showing that plants have consciousness, the secret life of plants, and so on and so forth, where plants can actually be seen to react to negative thoughts, thoughts for hurting the plant. The plants actually can seem to react in that way. It's not exactly accepted by mainstream science, but there is quite a growing body of information to show that plants respond to thoughts of human beings. Now, how do we avoid the karmic reactions for a non-meat diet? That's the negative. But we want to go further than just the negative. How can we prepare food in such a way that the eaters are spiritually inspired? After eating such a meal, they feel like, let me become more spiritually dedicated. Let me decrease my material desires, my material attachments. That is the most powerful cooking. And that's what we're concerned with tonight. Now, in my travels, I've observed many things in terms of food and the body. For example, although, as our kind announcer said, I was born in New York City. I'm based in Australia and New Zealand. I'm a citizen of New Zealand. So I've been there 15 years. So that brought upon me a problem I never expected. It's quite interesting, first-hand research here. When I come to the USA, I haven't yet experienced it in Canada. I've just been here a few days. But whenever I go to the USA, whenever I go to Russia, and whenever I go to most parts of India, I have trouble because the food is it's very low in potency. Whereas in Australia and New Zealand, even vegetables and fruits that are not certified organic, still they're quite low in chemicals, and the soil is quite low in chemicals, and therefore the food's very potent. So what happened, because I've been away from the USA and places like that for so long, my body's become accustomed to very powerful food. So when I come back to Los Angeles, for example, if I go to Moscow, even if I go to Delhi or Mumbai, people can't understand why I get so weak, because my body can't handle such low-grade food. I have to take all sorts of supplements, carry all sorts of energy bars with me, otherwise I don't make it. So this is, and not only have I noticed this with myself, but I have many friends from New Zealand who, when they come to visit the USA for, let's say, 6 months or a year, they also become very weak. So this is interesting research. But that's on the physical level. What about the consciousness? And I think you, as an advanced audience, should mostly be concerned with consciousness, because it is the consciousness that is your main asset. It is the consciousness, especially in a human being, that is the great gift. Because with your consciousness, you can understand how you're different from matter, and you can understand the supreme source of not only matter, but also of the spiritual energy. This is what Krishna consciousness is about. So how can we treat food and the preparing of food and the eating of food in such a way that we can even enter another dimension and our spiritual growth will be enhanced? This is what Bhakti Yoga is about. In the ancient text Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that someone who knows the yoga of eating can avoid karmic reaction, and indeed their eating propels them in spiritual advancement. So on the negative side, they're free from karma because they take permission of the source of all energy. They take permission from Krishna before they eat their diet. This is more than just gratitude. I have to point that out because probably like me, many of you are from the Judeo-Christian tradition to some degree when you were younger, or maybe right now, that's fine. So there, you are rightfully taught, before you take food, you offer a prayer of thanks. But this is not what I'm talking about. That's well and good, but I'm moving beyond that. I'm moving beyond gratitude to actual transformation of consciousness caused by the food. So there are proper yogic procedures given in the ancient Vedic texts for how to prepare food, how your consciousness should be situated while you're preparing the food, so that the eater becomes spiritually transformed. Here we can see a way to sanctify all of human society just by knowing how to have a sacred kitchen. Very, very interesting. I have seen countless people all over the world, when they taste food cooked by an advanced Krishna conscious person, an advanced spiritual practitioner in bhakti, they always say the same thing. There's just something special about this food. I can't put my finger on it. I've tasted all these ingredients before, but I don't know what's going on. Sometimes I even overhear people who are taking of such food that's offered to Krishna. I overhear them saying, I don't know, what is it? Do you think it's the chanting that does it? They can taste that there's something special. And for very attuned persons, very spiritually sensitive persons, they practically, they just fall in love with such food. And they get to the point where they feel they can't live their life without it. They've got to learn how to do the same thing because they've gotten such a elevation from such spiritually potent food. So this is what Krishna is describing in Bhagavad Gita. Beyond mere gratitude, any basic human being should be grateful. and appreciate. Thank you for the food. But we're moving far beyond that. We're moving into the realm of taking permission for preparing the food and then seeking to invoke the divine potency into the food so that the food becomes transformed. It's not the same, and it becomes a powerful catalyst for spiritual development. This is the true spirit of food. How can an ordinary person understand this? For someone who is addicted to flesh foods, it's practically impossible for them to understand. What I find in my travels around the world is that carnivorous persons don't understand they are unconsciously addicted to the taste of flesh and blood. When I point this out, they kind of, it's not like that. No. It's simply, everyone eats like this, and what's wrong with a steak? And what's wrong with a lamb chop? It's very difficult for them to see that indeed their tongue has a lust for flesh and blood. And sometimes they become quite repulsed when you say such a thing. I mean, I'm a human being. I'm civilized. But indeed, that's what it is. So that violent type of eating affects the consciousness. Similarly, for those who know the yogic art, the Krishna conscious art of preparing sanctified food, spiritualized food in the sacred kitchen, their cooking inspires extraordinary development in consciousness. So therefore, a main part of bhakti yoga is to train spiritual cooks who know how to cook as a yoga practice. How do they do it? An essential part of their cooking is the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. And they don't taste the food while they're cooking because they're considering that they want to first offer the food as it is to Krishna, and then they take it. So therefore, they don't want to taste the food before they make their offering. They want it untouched, so to speak. And only after they have made their offering, only after the processes of spiritual transformation of the food, do they then honor. And it's called not eating the food, it's called honoring the food because it's spiritualized. Now you may say, well, how do you cook without tasting it while you're cooking? It's completely possible. It's all about art. It's all about yoga technique. You see, this is another dimension of cooking. So, you don't taste the food, and you're always thinking while you're preparing the food, that I'm preparing this food for Krishna's pleasure, for the source, the pleasure of the source of all energy. And after I've offered this food, then I will take it. Now, there was something amusing. You see, in the way this process is explained traditionally in India, it can be kind of confusing. I've changed the language, but the way it's usually explained can be quite confusing. And I myself became confused when I first heard about it. So that was back in 1972. I had just graduated from Yale University, so that means I was pretty proud and thought I knew everything. So I read in the ancient spiritual texts from India that you offer the food to Krishna and you take the remnants. So that language just really threw me. I thought, I know what that means, and there's no way I'm doing this. What it means is you cook up a big pot of food and you offer it to Krishna, and then you take the pot and throw everything out, and whatever clings to the bottom of the pot, the remnants, that is what you eat. It's crazy, nowhere. I was being very literal. about the word remnant. Later, upon associating with Krishna conscious practitioners, bhakti yogis, I understood remnants refers to the spiritual reality that you offer the food to Krishna. Krishna has accepted it, and then you take the food as remnant, even though all the food is still there intact. Then I understood. And naturally, while I was trying to understand that, I was eagerly experiencing the culinary results. Yes, I can taste the difference. Just think how you could change people's consciousness through cooking. This is revolutionary. This is beyond vegetarianism and veganism. You can influence people with karma-free cooking. And even more than karma-free, a spiritually elevating cooking, so that their whole life can take another turn higher on the spiritual ladder just by tasting what you've cooked. That is the potency that's available in this offering of food to Krishna, this bhakti yoga technique, which has been going on in India since time immemorial, and now it's spreading all over the world. In other words, your cooking becomes elevated to another dimension, far beyond debates over, you know, should we eat meat or not. Actually, those kind of debates are not for civilized human beings. It's a shame that vegetarians and vegans actually have to defend themselves. So what kind of society you're living in? It should be unspoken. It's obvious. I remember, I've been to India 50 times, and as I'm sure you know, in the past 10 years, McDonald's has found its way to India. And with great PR efforts and advertising, they opened their first McDonald's in Delhi. But they were very shrewd. They knew that there's a big taboo in India against eating cow's flesh. So they understood. We can't trot out our usual Big Macs. So what they did, they figured that there's not such a taboo amongst the non-vegetarian population. There's not a taboo about eating lamb, but amongst the non-vegetarian population, there's a big taboo against eating cows. Of course, for the vegetarian, they don't touch any flesh, but for the non-vegetarian, they don't touch cows, but they'll eat, you know, lambs or pigs or whatever. So McDonald's came out with the answer. Instead of Big Macs in Delhi, they offer what are called Maharaj burgers, which are made of mutton, lamb. So in this way, they're tuning into the needs of the people. So anyway, I've watched all that happen, and it is quite disturbing. In fact, I knew of, I have to put it in the past, one of the recent CEOs of McDonald's, because he was Australian. He was a national icon, especially for an Australian to be in charge of such a huge multinational corporation, American-based as McDonald's. He was quite famous, and his countrymen were very proud of him. He was only 45 when he got to the top position in McDonald's. And so he was praised in all the newspapers and the media in Australia. One of ours has made it to the top. Top of what, though? Just think of all the bad karma that he gets. According to the ancient Vedic text, it's not simply the one who slaughters the animal who gets the karmic reaction. It's anyone who participates in the whole conspiracy. Just like when it comes to a human being. It's not simply the hitman, the trigger person, who gets criminally charged. It's anyone who's involved. The person who drives the killer away. The person who hides the killer. The person who helps plan the killing. They're all criminally charged. It's the same way with animal slaughter. Any place in the conspiracy that you have gets you a karmic reaction. Now, obviously, the trigger person, the slaughterer, gets most of the reaction. But still, everyone else also gets their share of the blame. So, instead of glorifying this man who became CEO of McDonald's or Strand at the age of 45, anyone with advanced consciousness would feel so sorry for him. What have you done to yourself? And indeed, unfortunately, less than a year after he became CEO of McDonald's, he was gone from cancer. And naturally, the Australians were just feeling very disturbed, like, why he attained the supreme position at the age of 45. He got the ultimate, and then he's gone within a year. What kind of world is this? Why did this happen? Well, why not look at his line of business? Now you may say, well, I know so many meat eaters who, you know, they're still around, they're doing well. But then you have to start considering the next life. That you reap what you sow, and that applies not only to this life, but also to future births. The karma mainly kicks in your next life. You see a premonition of it, or shall we say a precursor of it in this life, but it really affects your next life. And this life is mainly based on your karmic reactions from your past life. So how to stop this whole cycle of karmic reaction called samsara chakra, the wheel of samsara, or the wheel of repeated birth and death? That can be done through appropriate spiritual techniques. One of them is chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Another is to take sanctified food that has been offered to the supreme source of all energy, offered to Krishna. And that can actually break your karmic reactions. So therefore, the yoga practitioner who knows the technique of preparing spiritualized or Krishna-ized food can actually do people the greatest good. They think they're eating something so delicious, so tasty, they can't figure out where the special ingredients come from. Meanwhile, what's actually happening, besides the fact that they had a delightful culinary experience, their karma is being rearranged. So this puts enormous power to do good in the hands of the spiritual cook. And that's the point I'd like to emphasize tonight. You can take your cooking to the highest possible level, a level by which you can actually rearrange and eradicate people's karma, because you prepared food according to Krishna's directions. You played the game right, and therefore your food has assumed enormous potency. You see, there is a standard way of doing things. Yoga and meditation are not something that springs out of someone's personal invention. There are standard methods of yoga and meditation. The chanting of Hare Krishna is a standard mantra yoga practice. Similarly, there's a standard way of preparing food and eating. And if we follow those standard methods, we'll experience the results. And indeed, we can see the amazing power of food. It's not food in of itself, the spirit of food in of itself. It's because the food is a vehicle of connection to the supreme source, to Krishna, and therefore that food becomes something else, actually. It may seem like ordinary ingredients, but it's got such a dynamic spiritual potency to it. And any attuned person, any sensitive person can taste the results. I've seen it all over the world. Russia, South Africa, Argentina, Chile, Peru, Ecuador, China. I've been far above the Arctic Circle to the most northern city in the world, Murmansk. I've seen it everywhere. And sometimes even meat eaters can taste that there's something unique about this spiritually sanctified yoga food. I've seen that. And certainly those who are already vegetarians and vegans, they are, because of their cleaner system, so to speak, their cleaner consciousness, they immediately pick up on the results. So I like to present this as the next phase to go to, the spiritual kitchen, the sacred kitchen, and the spiritual empowerment of food, the preparing of food as a yoga meditational practice in bhakti. This has the means to influence so many people through an activity that everyone has to do, everyone has to eat. How can you or I prepare food in such a way as to elevate someone's consciousness? Isn't that a beautiful, loving thought? First of all, by the activity of preparing spiritual food, we elevate our own consciousness. And then, according to the development of our own consciousness, we can inspire others through the food. They become infected by your spiritual development. And this way it becomes easier for them to make spiritual progress because they've eaten your cooking. In other words, the preparing of spiritual food, of Krishna conscious food, is an act of pure love. And when others partake of the food you prepared, they are connecting to that pure love. In this way, you're actually expressing yourself in the most beautiful way. You're reaching out in the most beautiful way through your food that you prepared. Because you know the art of how to prepare the food according to the guidelines that will please the supreme source of that food and the supreme source of all consciousness, the supreme source of all pleasure. In this way, the food becomes so spiritually powerful. It's far beyond just mere bodily nourishment. So this is the ancient science of the spiritual kitchen that I wanted to present to you tonight. It's something real, it's something anyone can do. Now, if you want to get into it, there are different levels of the spiritual kitchen. Advanced bhakti practitioners, they keep their kitchen spotless. And certainly, as I said, they don't taste what they are cooking while they're cooking. Like, well, let me make sure that's coming out right. Don't do that. Everything is kept so perfectly clean. It's not fanaticism. It is personal sensitivity. I'm preparing an offering for the Supreme, for Krishna. Therefore, everything, all the circumstances must be optimal. This is devotion. That's what bhakti means. Pure, transcendental love and devotion for the Supreme Source of everything, for Krishna. So therefore, the kitchen of the bhakti yogi is spotless. And the cook is also spotless. The cook is very careful to be properly showered, very careful that no hairs fall into the food as he or she is preparing it, very careful about the pots that are used. A bhakti yogi cooks don't like using pots that people have prepared meat in because such pots are considered contaminated subtly. So all these circumstances are taken into account. And then, once the food is cooked, often accompanied by the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, the food is presented as a devotional offering to Krishna, and then everyone else can take. In this way, you can spread divine love just by your cooking. And it's such a satisfying feeling to know you can make a difference through your cuisine. You're not only nourishing people's bodies and giving their tongue pleasing sensations, but you're also elevating their spiritual consciousness. So I would like to think that this is the next step awaiting those fortunate persons who are free from the web of the conspiracy of animal slaughter, which is so deadening the world. Why is it that there are these senseless wars? Just like I'm across the border, so I can freely talk about these things. I'm a New Zealand citizen, so the brain. And as I was explaining the past few days, I've been giving talks here, that don't worry, I was not at Yale when George Bush was there. He graduated a year before I started. Don't hold him against me, please. But anyway, when you ask the typical American, how did the Vietnam War come about? What were you guys doing there? I remember during my university days, it was such a heated protest. The students were so angry. We could be sent to the jungles to die for what? What's the commotion about? Now, 35 or so years later, no one can figure out what the hell they were doing there. They can't figure it out. It doesn't make sense now that they look back at it. But what? Something is entangling the people once again in another war. And even this war, half the public is scratching their heads like, what's going on? Still it goes on. Now, the ancient Vedic texts say you have to know what the wind is that's causing the rub, the friction, and the fire. That inexplicable wind, which seems to be invisible. That wind is the karmic reactions from animal slaughter, as we said. And until that animal slaughter is eradicated, you're always going to have these senseless wars, senseless brutalities. Because you reap what you sow. If you're sponsoring on a wholesale, mass level, cruelty to creatures, that has to come back to you on a mass level of slaughter. You look at the 20th century. It is the most violent century in all of recorded human history. In fact, if you take all the violent deaths caused by war from 1 BC on up to 1999, combine those numbers together, more people died from violent war conflict in the last century, last 100 years, than all the preceding 1900 years combined. So, the point still stands. It's such a dramatic amount. So you might say, oh, bigger population, but it's not enough to compensate. But 1900 years are surpassed by 100 years. That is my point. So, if we can see that the cause is improper diet, we'll be doing the world a great benefit. And then if we can go beyond that, how to elevate people to pure love, to advance spiritual consciousness just by our cooking, then we've done ourselves and the world great service. We're actually agents of transformation, agents of change, just operating out of our kitchens. So this is what I wanted to share with you tonight, especially since you're a very refined audience. I wanted that you consider this possibility, the kitchen religion, this yogic art of preparing sacred food in a spiritual kitchen. I think it opens up enormous possibilities for self-transformation and global transformation. So I'll stop here and see if maybe you have some questions. Yes.
How, you mentioned that you were in the Arctic.
Excuse me?
You mentioned that you were in the Arctic.
Yes.
And I wondered how you impart it to a native population who doesn't have access to vegetables on a regular basis. And in its native way, always thanks the spirit of the animals that they did kill for sacrificing itself for their food. How do you get that message across to people who don't have vegetables?
Those are exceptional circumstances, and those exceptional circumstances are covered in the ancient Vedic texts. They say that if you're in a situation in which there is no other alternative, then because the principle is jivo jivasya jivanam, Sanskrit aphorism, one living end is food for another. Only then, regretfully, can you avail yourself of other sources of food. But this is an exception. Yes, I've been to the Arctic Circle to Murmansk, and there are so many vegetarians and vegans there. Now, obviously, their food is not grown locally. Which would lead you to another question, such as, what are you guys doing up there anyway? But why are they up there? Why do they have this big city above far above the Arctic Circle? Because the Russians built a nuclear naval base there and then offered higher wages to those who would live far above the Arctic Circle and, you know. And furthermore, the aging nuclear fleet of the former Soviet Union, what do they do with it? It's all mothballed in the harbor of this city for the bad health of the residents there. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why they're there. Defense industry, bigger wages. Otherwise, they shouldn't be living there. But yes, there are some what are called native persons who have a natural habitat there. That's an exception. And indeed, the ancient Vedic texts say if there's nothing else around, even sometimes human beings from temperate areas, due to some circumstance, they can't get any other kind of food, then they are allowed, regretfully. So it's an exception. But we're talking about general circumstances. All right? Very good question. Thank you. Yes?
Hi, you're talking about the CEO, the Australian CEO, how he died after a year. And that's sort of the life that he had, something like that.
Well, everyone dies because of the life they led. But yeah, I understand what you mean. Yes?
Okay, so how would you compare that, then, I guess, in comparison to karma and maybe like children, let's say, dying in Africa?
Right. You see, now we're getting away from our topic into the intricacies of karma. If you're ready for that, I can do that. Okay. You see, actually, there's no such thing from the overall viewpoint of an innocent child. Everyone is bringing the seeds of their karmic reactions from their past life into the present life. So it's just a question of time for when those karmic reactions come out. Let me give an example. Perhaps many of us can remember our years before 11, 12, or 13 when the hormones started to boil. Weren't those carefree days? Free from certain anxieties and hang-ups. But can you say that you were an innocent child in that respect? No. All the adults understand that when the right age comes, out come these seeds, so to speak, these hormones start to boil. Now, from the viewpoint of India's spiritual texts, it's because of reactions from the previous life that you have a body which has these hormones that start to boil at a certain age. By the way, are there any men here who are 22, around 22? If you are, you should know that according to science, you are at the peak of your hormone intensity. For females, it's different, but for men, they really are raging. So, now, were they innocent before all that hormone action started to go on? No. They were little children, and their bodies were waiting to reach a certain point of maturation and all these things come out. So similarly, according to the ancient spiritual texts of India, the body is a karmic reaction. You get a particular body based on your activities and consciousness in the previous life. So in the present body is packed the seeds of karmic reactions for things you've already done. And then meanwhile, you're busy accruing new karmic reactions based on your current lifestyle. So at every moment, you're influenced both by the past and your creating of your own future. It's not fatalistic, like, oh, you're just a slave of the past, and you have no individuality, no free choice. No, both things are going on at once. You're carrying the burden of the past, and you're generating a future. Of course, it is true that your generating of your future is it's conditioned or impinged upon by your past. Still, the past and the future are a simultaneous reality for you. So those are the teachings of the law of karma as stated in Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. A bit off the topic, but quite interesting, especially when it comes to the reactions to animal slaughter. Anything else?
Yeah, I have a question.
Sure.
You mentioned that when you leave Australia, there's a difference in the food,
yeah,
and that you take something else.
Mm.
Is that something you recommend, or?
No, I'm not a nutritionist. It's something I have to do. I have to take, you know, spirulina twice a day. I mean, you know, I have to take whey protein, soy protein. Mm. Of course, I'm particular about the cows where I get my, that's another advantage. If you know how to source, for example, whey protein that comes from cows that aren't slaughtered, that aren't treated in a cruel way. Otherwise, yeah, I'm quite careful about dairy products. So anyway, yeah, I have to do that. It's not that I recommend it to everyone. I'm not a nutritionist, but it's something I have to do. And in this way, I become firsthand aware of the potency in food, both materially and spiritually. That was my point. Not so much to give nutritional advice.
Right, but what about organic food? What about organic food?
I can't get organic food in Russia.
How about the States?
Well, it depends on who's my host. it depends on where I am at and where I'm staying. Naturally, I would prefer that, but I can't, because I travel so much, I can't demand that all the time, because organic food generally, not all the time, but generally comes at a premium. So I'd be kind of rude guest if I told my host, hey, I'm not eating dinner unless it's organic. Maybe I might just say that, but...
The point
being,
organic food is Australian organic food, and
state
should be the same, right? We should be the same.
I haven't done any scientific comparison. My point was to show that, first of all, there are differing material potencies of food, and more importantly, there can be different spiritual potencies of food. That was my point. Yes.
My question is, the transformation of the evolution state of consciousness of human life, where do we go from here? in terms of, is there a place where we can go to beyond violence, beyond this state? I mean, even she says yourself, eating plants is a form of less distressive.
Yes,
is there an alternative to that in eventual evolutionary stages of the future?
There is a way to spiritualize not only sound vibration, as we heard through the Hare Krishna mantra, not only food, as we discussed, but also there's a way to spiritualize all energy once you recognize the source of the energy and follow the instruction manual how to deal with that energy. So that is what Krishna consciousness is about, to be conscious that there is a proprietor, a source of everything, and that there are instructions for how to deal with all that energy. It's completely different consciousness than wandering around thinking the world is, at my beck and call. I decide how I interact with everything. It's completely different. You're recognizing that energy has a source, and you have obligations and responsibilities to that source, especially as a conscious human being. Human beings have much more developed consciousness than other creatures. So, now, don't be surprised that ordinary scientists have such a difficult time understanding how plants, trees, insects can be conscious. As I said, they have a tough time understanding what is consciousness in a human being. So what to speak of other creatures. So, there is a way to change all of the energies of this world through proper development of consciousness. We've just touched on two major aspects, sound, vibration, and food. But, you know, I can go on and on about the other things.
So you're saying it's a very open-ended process?
Meaning open-ended?
Meaning like thinking of the, okay, there's a source, there's an action, and then there's a result. Is it open-ended? Open-ended in terms of, okay, I'm doing this with my life, with my, I'm developing more spiritual consciousness, but transcendent. But the open-endedness is where I go with it. What happens in the overall experience as a result of my action?
Oh, you're really going in, you're heading to deep water, aren't you? Very good, I appreciate that. How far do you want to go? Yes. You can get to the highest level of yoga mysticism in which you don't see matter anymore. You see all the energy as directly connected to the Supreme, to Krishna, and your vision of that is so intense that whenever you see the energy, you immediately see the energetic source simultaneously. This is what Krishna said, means when he says in Bhagavad Gita, for one who sees everything in me and me in everything, I'm never lost to him and he's never lost to me. This is considered the topmost yogi. That is another big very nice. I'm very enlivened to hear you wanting to go there. Any other questions? Yes.
I guess it's more of a more common question, and with all due respect, but it's just I'm kind of going back to the comments about the whey protein and where and how sourcing as dairy. Kind of important for people to understand that the dairy industry, even more so in many aspects than the meat industry, is inherently more cruel and has a lot more. It's actually more harmful to the animal than the meat industry itself. I mean, from its most basic level, you're talking about the confinement of a being. You're talking about a being who is ritually inseminated every year to keep milk production up. You're stealing the milk, you're taking away the baby and sending the male babies off to the meal industry and sending the females into this torturous life of just constant, constant pain. So I think just want people to kind of understand that dairy is...
That's why I made that distinction, yes. I'm aware of farmers who don't slaughter their cows and who take very nice care of them. So that is especially common in New Zealand and Australia. I don't know so much about the USA and Canada. So therefore, when I travel, I have a lot of weight. I'm bringing my supplements with me. I know where they come from.
Right. Well, what I'm saying, with all due respect, but I guess one of the big issues with dairy, even if it is from somewhere that, because I've had these discussions with people who purchase their milk from farmers who they consider are humane farmers, so an organic farmer. But the main issue that kind of creeps in is that right from the start, you're confining a being and subjugating this being to your whims and your will. And at the same time, you also set in motion all of these other aspects. I mean, a cow must be inseminated every year in order to keep milk production. This is a function of being a male. When this cow has a baby, in order for you to sell milk, you have to take this baby away, otherwise you have no milk to sell.
There's
separation from mother and child. And then the male calves, I mean, they have to do something with these male calves. They don't raise them. Otherwise they're not economically viable as a business.
Yes, this is a point. But as I say, I personally deal with farmers who don't participate in at all in animal slaughter. Those are rare, but that's what I personally do.
I would love to.
Yes. yes. They do exist. And they're laughed at because it doesn't seem to make economic sense. But they have other purposes than just economics. Indeed, we'd have to go to another subject, which I may speak about Tuesday at the Rothman's? Yes. spiritual economics. So tonight I'm just disciplining myself and staying within a certain subject. Okay. Thank you. Yes.
In the cycle of birth and death and reincarnation, I presume certain animals can eventually take the form of humans and then evolve that way. Is there things that humans can do in this lifetime that can cause them to go back and take an animal life in their next lifetime?
That's a very good question. Yes. It's a two-way street. The laws of karma mean that if with this human body you engage in activities that are not very different from animal activities, and you waste your gift of developed human consciousness, then the laws of nature can say, why should you have a human body again? Better you get a match according to your proclivities. Yes. Therefore, that's another reason why, as the gentleman was saying, we should be very considerate about how animals are treated. They are conscious entities. And not only do you get a bad reaction for unnecessarily being cruel to them, but they're not that much different than people today. Not that much different. Consider the animal's specialties. Eating, sleeping, mating, and protecting itself. Most human beings, they unfortunately, they're caught up in these four pursuits in a more sophisticated way. All right, add a little bit of cultural expression on top. But then again, if you look at certain insects, you'll find a level of social integration that far surpasses human beings. So what makes the human beings special? They have the developed consciousness to actually understand what is energy and the source of energy and how to act in such a way as to uplift their own consciousness and the consciousness of others.
But then you think that, I don't know if you use the word most or the majority of people are sort of living animal lives that in human bodies?
I would say that, and it sounds very severe, because most people don't even understand the need to refrain from animal slaughter, which puts them in a very severe category. So, I wouldn't say that, perhaps, to any other audience except this one. But this is the tragedy. That's why I was talking about how wars happen inexplicably. No one could figure out years later, why did we have this war? Why did we march off to this war? But the link is there between the animal slaughter and the human wars. Yes. Yes.
Hi. It's not a question, it's just a further comment about animals. I think we can learn a lot from animals. Mm-hmm. We can learn how to live with science and nature and tap into our own intuition and to live more holistic, fulfilled, authentic lives. So I actually sometimes see animals as being higher developed than humans. That's just my comment.
I can see you're saying that, and I would agree. In most cases, unfortunately, it's true the way people are living. And yes, an intelligent human being learns from all aspects of nature, animals, plants, trees. The higher your consciousness is, the more you can learn about, you'll see lessons in everything. You'll see tolerance in the tree. The tree doesn't protest when someone carves their initials, doesn't protest when you take its leaves or even its bark. This is tolerance. This is humility. So yes, you can learn. The shrewd person can learn from all aspects of nature. And indeed, that's a very significant part of yoga practice, how to learn from nature. But I was speaking about the situation in a more tragic sense, that yes, we're obviously concerned for the well-being of animals. But when human beings neglect their special gift of developed consciousness and simply engage in polished versions of animal activities, this is a great tragedy. That's my point. But yeah, I have a very good comment that you made. So, we had a little something for you. Yes?
Yeah. Can we make you an announcement?
Ah, okay. We had some announcements for you. But thank you so much for your kind attention.